Welcome to the CSIS podcast. I'm Colm Quinn. This week, U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter previewed the $582 billion defense budget for this year as the U.S. plans out its strategy to deal with threats ranging from the Middle East to the South China Sea. The proposal includes a dramatic increase in spending on its operations in Europe as the United States recognizes a more aggressive Russia and seeks to reassure NATO allies of its commitment to the region. It's a long way from 2009, when Russia and the US reset relations. To discuss this apparent pivot to Europe and the kind of message it sends is Kathleen Hicks, Senior Vice President, Head of the International Security Program at CSIS, and coincidentally, the author of a new CSIS report out this week on the future of the US Army in Europe. We begin by looking at this shift in focus by the US.
Well, it most fundamentally and directly goes back to the Russian decision to annex Crimea. And of course, there were incidents before that and since that, with the sense that being primarily Russia's actions in Syria, that all of which have indicated pretty clearly that the Russians are not in the reset space that we had hoped for. There was a period where they seemed to be more so, particularly when Medvedev was in charge. Historians will have to decide if that was ever the case or not. But certainly we can say today that the Russians have indicated clearly that they view NATO's presence on its border, which is in fact where NATO is in the case of Poland and the Baltic states, as a threat. And the United States and NATO see that as sovereign NATO, NATO territory that we are pledged to defend. And so we have to have the capability to make that defense credible. And that's the origin of the beginning of the recommendations this week.
Because it's very real now. I mean, before, when Russia invaded Crimea and annexed it, it was a lot of talk. You know, Ukraine wasn't a NATO member, therefore different rules applied. But this is very real. This is putting troops, this is putting arms, this is spending a lot of money to up the presence there. Is there a danger, and I'm sure you've thought of this, that this is just going to further irk and lead to more aggressive behavior from Russia?
Yeah, that's always, that's always the calculus that you have to make, right? Which is, what is deterrence and what is actually provocative? And so the emphasis that we've made in our report, which was long in coming and quite coincidentally comes out in a good coincidence, comes out this week at the same time as Carter's making his budget preview statements on this same topic, it is to indicate that there's a defensive posture. Is it a deterrent posture? We already, NATO, we, with the U.S. as a key component of that, have been stepping up our exercises, our activities to demonstrate we can defend. These are not, efforts that look to demonstrate an ability to strike, for instance, into Russian territory. They are demonstrations of our ability to defend. And the same is true of the announcements Carter made this week about how we're going to step up our capability. And in the CSIS report you referenced, we're very focused on trying to make that line as clear as possible. Now, that said, there's no doubt that Putin will, because he has already, and Russian media has already, will spin those NATO activities already underway as provocative. So, there is this risk of miscalculation, but what we want to make sure of is that Russian forces and the Russian leadership understand, I have no doubt about the Article 5 commitment to NATO territory, and that we can show credibly our ability to defend that territory and roll back any Russian actions that could occur there.
And what kind of counter-messaging is that then? What do we have to speak directly to Russia? What ways can the U.S. and, I suppose, the West show that this isn't aggressive?
There's obviously the rhetoric, but that's only goes so far. The key issue is the types of capabilities that you deploy and how you position and posture them. So, for instance, the U.S. has made no decisions, and nor in the CSIS report do we recommend basing, for instance, U.S. or NATO forces far forward into the Baltic states and Poland. We do talk about having presence, sort of a consistent, not terribly large scale, presence of forces that demonstrate an ability to defend territory. territory. So that's an example of a clear line that we've drawn to say, you know, we could obviously have been very provocative, put forces there. We're not going to do that. Other things like the missile defenses that the Russians really dislike in Europe, they have had their radars focused on Iran. That has not changed. There hasn't been an effort to transition our missile defense capability to focus on Russia. So we've stuck by with our actions, this rhetoric that we've used, that these capabilities are really pointed toward rogue states. We do talk about, for instance, increasing armored brigade capacity, which also the Pentagon, it looks like, is doing as well. But we don't increase it to a point where the Russians could think we were attempting to have an invasion size force. It's not a substantial size increase. It's really about an ability to defend territory. So those are the ways we try to communicate it. And of course, it has to sit within a broader U.S. diplomatic informational economic message about how we view Russian activity.
You know, you look at the money that's being spent, you look at the strategy that's being thought out directly from Russia's actions. Will these kind of steps that are being taken by the Pentagon, these kind of steps on the other side that you guys are recommending, is this something that will prevent another Crimea, that perhaps on a NATO state, like somewhere in the Baltics, is that's directly being thought of?
So the way I would describe how we approached it in our CSIS report, the Pentagon decisions go along the route that the CSIS report does, but we frankly go further. So I think it's fair to say that, you know, where the Pentagon is along the lines where we are, which is we're not trying to build a force that can literally stop a Russian advance into stop a Russian advance into the Baltic states or Poland, for example. Rather, we are trying to put up a credible deterrent, which means that the risks and costs for the Russians we hope to communicate with this force would be significant enough that it would be foolhardy for them to pursue such an approach. Because of the geographic character of the region, the fact that the Russians can move up to the border with these countries through entirely internal lines within Russia gives them incredible immediate advantage that the U.S. cannot in any kind of cost-constrained way turn that calculus around. But what we can do is complicate their calculus, and that's the heart of deterrence.
What's this say about the posture of our allies? Is the U.S. seeing that they need to step in more? Is there more needed then from allies to step up as well?
There's no doubt there's more needed from allies, and some allies have been very responsive in terms of ever since the annexation of Crimea, in terms of committing more presence to the eastern border. But NATO overall, especially the European and Canadian elements of NATO, overall there is a decline in resourcing. There is a commitment that the countries have made to get, of course, to this 2% of GDP, this goal of spending 2% of GDP on defense. That has not occurred for most countries, all but four, I think, is the current count. And the migration crisis that's occurring in Europe further complicates that, because there's a lot of spending that is very arguably also in the security realm that needs to go into that space. So there's a competition for resources. It's a very challenging environment, European security right now, because you have not just the Russian threat, not just the migration crisis, not just the internal ISIS threats to states, but you also have, of course ISIS itself to the south. And that's a hard environment to expect a lot of increased investment specifically to the eastern challenge.
Right. We talked about complexities and forgetting all about 2016, the U.S. itself is stretched as it is. We talked about ISIS, but also there's the rebalancing towards Asia, where the U.S. increasingly has to see itself. Can it all be sustained? Can it all be done in the right way? And can everything be dealt with at once?
You know, one of my old bosses was Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, and he always liked to say we can walk and chew gum. You know, we can in theory. Certainly, the United States has the wherewithal as a nation to do these missions in multiple regions. But we have to have the resources to do it, and we have to have the national interest to do it. And that's where I think, you know, you come at these issues. The world is at this point, I should say, right at a time when the United States, of course, is coming to grips politically with who it is and what its consensus, if any, on foreign policy is. And that's very much, I think, at stake. So I imagine that the next administration, if it can, whoever that is, if it can build a consensus around what are the interests that we really think we need to protect in the world, and then what is the resource strategy for getting there? If it can build that through leadership, I do think we can take these challenges on. But that's a lot to ask in a domestic political climate as fraught as the U.S. has right now.
And that was Kat Hicks bringing us to the end of this week's show. If you'd like to read her report, you can find it on our website, csis.org. That's it from me. Thanks for listening.